You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 31st of October 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up.
Now, I'm sure that some of you may have heard about a letter that the FBI director sent out yesterday. Well, if you're like me, you probably have a few questions about it.
How did a letter so light on detail ignite so much havoc? My guests, Mary Jodefsky and Jeffrey Howard, would join me to unravel the latest surprise in the most bizarre presidential race in memory. Plus,
I started off in Brooklyn. My father gave me a small loan of $1 million. I came into Manhattan and I had to pay him back, and I had to pay him back with interest.
Does anyone really know who Donald Trump is? We'll assess more than 5 hours of audio recorded with the GOP nominee shortly before his presidential run. We'll also consider what happens when the law doesn't quite get it right. And a little later... Keep your screams to a minimum, please. On the spookiest night of the year, we'll consider how and why Halloween has become a global phenomenon. That's all to come on Midori House, live from London with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House on this cold, dark Halloween night. My guests today are Jeffrey Howard, lecturer in political theory at University College here in London, and Mary Jodefsky, columnist for The Independent and The Guardian newspapers. Welcome both to the programme. Now, how did a letter so light on detail ignite such furore that could dramatically alter America's political future? It's a question likely being asked by many within Hillary Clinton's campaign after the revelation that emails found on devices used by disgraced former Congressman Anthony Weiner have prompted the FBI to investigate whether they might relate to the now closed investigation into Hillary Clinton's private email server. Mary, there have been so many twists and turns on this story, and we felt this had gone away. It was the story that kind of blighted the start to her campaign, and here it is back again with just days to go before the vote. First of all, tell us whether you think the email story is significant in what they've found, and also significant in what you think it will do to the campaign.
Well, in terms of what they've found, I think so far it's really been quite unimpressive. It's more the fact that Hillary Clinton appeared to be trying to bypass the inbuilt surveillance system when she was Secretary of State, or, as she would probably present it, trying to make something both more convenient and more secure. Now, I think from this side of from the British side of the Atlantic, it's actually quite difficult to understand why there was such a furore about this. But it was partly explained to me last week when I was at a meeting with quite a few American academics and consultants. And I said, what is this? And they said, well, look, we know people, very, very senior people, who in our view have been subject to enormous fines, have been hauled through the courts, who've even gone to prison for breaching confidentiality in a way that they thought was actually less than how Hillary Clinton appears to have breached it. And this is the problem for her in the United States.
But the second part of that was what it would do to the campaign. So we have some figures here which Real Clear Politics has put Clinton at 3.9 percentage points ahead of the Republicans nationwide, which is down from 7.11 points just 10 days ago. So it feels like it's hit the campaign. Do you think that's going to be long lasting?
It's very strange to me that it appears to have had this effect, because my impression was that the email saga had been factored in a long time ago. So I'm slightly surprised that it appears to have had this effect, and as to whether it is actually the emails or whether people people are having, you know, second thoughts for other reasons. I don't know. The other thing, of course, that has to be taken into account is that quite a number of Americans have already voted. Now, to my mind, you know, this is just a really peculiar feature of the American system, which I find, you know, as questionable as the very generous use of postal ballots in the UK. There's just a long time that Americans can cast their votes. And this means that if there is any late development, then they've already cast their vote. So it makes there will be a proportion who might either regret or be standing by because they were Hillary stalwarts all along.
Jeffrey, what's really fascinating about this is when you sit outside the US, of course, you know, Trump seems like such a kind of a crazy buffoon, and that's how he's presented in a way that you can't understand anything he's saying. It doesn't filter through to you. But for a US audience, we know from these numbers, it's pretty divided the country what they think of Clinton and of Trump. Now, what Trump says about Clinton is, you know, in basic terms, lock her up. She broke the rules. You know, she should go to jail for what she's done. Now, we've got to a point where the FBI is saying, well, we certainly need to look at what she's doing a second time. And as Mary's just said, you know, very rational, ordinary people that Mary's bumped into have said, well, people who did far less have been locked up. You know, Mary wasn't quite shouting, lock her up. But are we misjudging the situation a little bit? And it is much more serious than we think. Or do you think that this is, again, you know, as the Clintons say, just kind of, you know, bad timing?
I think it's both bad timing and it is very serious. Look, it's very important that political officials not simply avoid corruption, but also avoid the appearance of corruption. And I agree entirely that that's probably exactly what FBI Director Comey was doing when he decided to write this quite vague letter to Congress a few days ago. But I think that simply tells us that he's in a really difficult situation. And when you're in a difficult situation and you think you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't, the right thing to do, I think, is follow precedent. And the longstanding FBI precedent was to, never mind not disclosing details of an ongoing investigation, FBI normally doesn't even tell people, the public, when public officials are under investigation. And I think that clearly would have been the prudent call. And as a result, I think he's going to put the question of Hillary's integrity, her charges that she's subject to corruption, front and center of voters' mind when they go to the polls in over a week.
And he was advised by the Justice Department not to do this. You're saying that he was in a difficult spot, but why do you think he decided to ignore that advice?
That's a really interesting question. Presumably he thinks he knows better than the Justice Department officials who reminded him, it seems time and again, that longstanding Justice Department protocol on this was not to interfere in an election or even appear that you were interfering in an election. Perhaps he thought, as Mary rightly suggests, that he'd be found out and the Republicans would be outraged to hear after Hillary Clinton has been elected president of the United States that there had been a reopening of the criminal investigation. But I think that he was in a really tough situation and he's probably made the wrong call.
And Jeffrey, the same question to Mary. Do you think it will tip the election?
I think there's a natural tightening that inevitably transpires at this stage, this close to the polls. And I think this probably exacerbated the tightening. Will it exacerbate it to such a degree that Hillary ends up losing? I doubt that. But I do think it means that Hillary Rodham Clinton is going to leave the gate wounded. I think she's going to face a legitimacy crisis of the same kind that rattled Barack Obama, with plenty of people saying that corruption was what got her through the gate and into the White House. And she's going to face a much higher probability of being a one-term president as a result.
And Mary, when we look at Trump's campaign, oddly, you know, there's been so much dirt and so many kind of complicated stories. Nothing really seems to be sticking to him at this point. He seems to have, you know, shirked off all of the sexual allegations, all of the kind of the horrible language that came out. It feels like he's managed to just walk away from that because of this story.
Well, I think that's true, but I don't understand why the Democrat campaign hasn't pursued the women issue alongside the emails.
Because he says that they're lying, and unfortunately for his constituency, they kind of believe him.
Yes, but you know, if I was the Democrat National Committee, I would be making sure I'd got an aggrieved woman to put out there every day, a different one. And it appears that, you know, we have been given to believe that they exist, so it shouldn't be too difficult for them. But obviously they've got to answer the email thing, because if they try to divert attention from that, if it looks as though they're trying to divert attention from that simply by not answering it, then they lose on that front completely. And I think it was so interesting that Hillary Clinton went out there, not quite immediately, but almost as soon as she'd had time to take advice and just went for the charges straight away.
Well, she's handled it as much as she can in a very interesting way. She's been on the front foot. She didn't wait. Geoffrey, just before we move on to more investigation into Mr. Trump, one of the claims from the Democrats is, you know, that the FBI have dirt on him about his connections with Russia and with Putin and the business machine that he's involved in, and that they refuse to give any hint about what that's about. So they are therefore politicized in this issue. Do you think there's any justice in that claim?
I think there's the appearance of justice in that claim, and that's bad enough. I think the FBI needs to bend over backwards to make sure that there isn't this appearance of impropriety, and that means adopting consistent standards when it comes to Mrs. Clinton and Mr. Trump. And there's a risk that they haven't done that, and I think that just goes to show that the FBI is mishandling this situation, and I think it's going to pose real problems for Mrs. Clinton if she's elected president.
Now, we're going to move on to a story that appeared in the New York Times, which is a fascinating piece which tries to unpack exactly who Mr. Trump is. It's based on a series of interviews that he did for his biographer some time ago, Michael D'Antonio, which was just before the campaign began. And it looks at who is Trump the man. And the piece comes up with some fascinating answers, Mary. It says, you know, here's a man who, most of all, more than anything else, is kind of scared about what his mark will be, what he'll be thought of in the future. He's somebody who has almost no care about the past or history. He is completely convinced he's an absolute genius and has never put a foot wrong. It's a fascinating piece. What did you take away from the story that is being most interesting about the character of Trump?
Well, the story that appealed to me most was from, I think, his wife when she was dating him, and she was taken skiing, and what he didn't know was rather vital that he needed to know, which was that she was absolutely fantastic skier, and so while he rather fancied himself in the skiing department, he found himself very quickly eclipsed. And loss of face, it appears, almost put an end to their relationship right then and there. Now, the slight question in my mind from that is, well, it all turned out all right in the end for him, and apparently for her. So that loss of face, which this article and the interview that it's based on, is a sort of centerpiece of their of the analysis of sort of what drives Trump. It appears that loss of face may not be quite so crucial as is the sort of leading theme for this article.
And Geoffrey, the other fascinating thing is that he makes it clear that, you know, he has no respect really for anybody. He says, you know, that people just don't deserve your respect in the end because, you know, that they're not great people around you. And it makes you wonder if that feeds into the way that he's, you know, kind of treated the people around him, men and women in particular. He just doesn't think they're up to it. Again, it's a really interesting piece. What was your takeaways?
I mean, what's striking about the piece is, first, it reveals the moral criteria by which he judges others. And from what I can tell, they're not moral criteria at all. It's how successful are you? How famous are you? There's no narrative of virtue and dignity. There's no narrative about what it means to live a good life or be a just person. These seem like wholly alien ideas to him. But I tell you, the thing that really emerged most strongly to me after reading this piece was that he's not a self-scrutinizer. He doesn't look at himself in the mirror and he says, how can I be a better person? What did I do wrong today and how can I do better? He's completely alien. And what shows this is that he's already publicly embarrassed himself in the eyes of so many Americans. And yet he claims, or the piece claims, that public embarrassment is the number one thing he's trying to avoid. And I think this speaks to a very verging on delusional personality. And that's a real problem for voters who are asking, you know, what kind of decisions is he going to make in the White House?
And this same idea, which I mentioned, that he doesn't like to look at the past. You know, he said, I'm about the present and the future. I don't want to think about the past. And again, that kind of excuses you from all sorts of behavior as well, because in a way you know, oh, the past is the past, it doesn't belong to me anymore. It kind of explains his personality a little bit, that he's able to just shrug off anything that's horrible or that's a failure in the past.
Yeah, I think that mentality may help some people succeed in life, but it's a terrible mentality for a leader to have. It's so important that public officials study history, that they learn from history, and that they try to implement the lessons of history moving forward. But if you're not going to be willing at all to look at history, how can you implement its lessons?
I'd just like to take a slightly sideways view of that, because I was a correspondent in Moscow through the end of the Soviet Union, and one of the things I did in the months after the Soviet Union fell is that I went systematically around all the new independent countries and tried to interview the leaders. And I did interview most of them. And it came across to me quite clearly that there were two very distinct types of leader. One of them were the people who, the sort of action men, who didn't think about it, had no interest in history. They were all about doing things. And then there were the people who thought about it the whole time and cogitated and reflected and tried to rationalize things, both going forward and going backwards. And you had to say that there wasn't a particular distinction in the actual effect that they had as national leaders. So I just think that's quite interesting.
Well, the report's by Michael Barbro, and it makes fascinating reading, because it does come to the conclusion that his fear of being forgotten kind of, or in the end, almost overrides everything. Well, have a dip into it. You'll find it online. But you're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Mary Jezewski and Jeffrey Howard. Still to come, what happens when justice systems get it wrong? And we'll also ask, what's sure to be the most important question of today? Trick or treat? Stay tuned.
Hurry, grab your popcorn. It's nearly showtime here on Monocle 24, but before the movie starts, let me tell you about our program dedicated to the best in film, The Cinema Show. Tune in every week to hear from filmmakers, critics and luminaries of the genre as we shine a spotlight on everything from revivals and the restoration of vintage cuts to European films and the role of the auteur.
I never think of architecture or cities or landscapes in cinema as merely being a kind of neutral backdrop to the action. They are the action themselves.
So whether it's the Oscar-winning film director Neil Jordan...
The truth is that writing a novel and directing a film, you can be as utterly alone in both activities, you know.
Or the renowned composer Michael Nyman.
When there's some strange kind of integration of what I do as a composer with what, on this occasion, I do as a filmmaker, you can't really take one thing away from another.
We've got the inside word on what to watch. The Cinema Show on Monocle 24 in association with MUBI, premiering Fridays at 20:00 London time, or catch up via the podcast. Quick now, find your seat. The movie's starting.
The freshly minted Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining is a handbook for people who enjoy honest, locally made food. It's also about the other, sometimes overlooked elements that make a great meal. Honed hosting skills, getting the light right, and owning the sharpest kitchen kit. As well as offering up our favorite restaurants, bars, and cafes from Adelaide to Zurich, the world's freshest markets, shops, and most inspiring producers. It's also a book for people who want to turn their love of food into their livelihood. Hungry for more? We thought you might be. The Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining is published by Gestalten and available now from monocle.com/shop. Or at any good bookshop.
You're listening to Midori House live from London. I'm Andrew Tuck. Now, a series of criminal cases currently making their way through the United Kingdom's courts could result in a fundamental shift in how errors in the legal system are handled. A decision by the Supreme Court back in February found that the application of the law on joint enterprise, otherwise known as common enterprise, had taken a wrong turn and had been misinterpreted for 30 years. This so-called wrong turn raises some important questions of how the UK's legal system handles such a massive misinterpretation of the law. Jeff, let's just start with it. Let's just explain for people around the world who don't quite understand what this concept is about of joint enterprise. This is the notion that if, for example, somebody is stabbed by one person, but you are in attendance or you are in a group of people who are kind of present, even if you are not proved to have had any intent of taking part in the attack, or probably weren't going to take part in the attack, you can get the same sentence. You can be sent to jail for many, many years. Is that in legal, in my rough legal terms, is that about right?
That's about right. So it's a doctrine in criminal law that says that even though you didn't, strictly speaking, perform the criminal act, you didn't deliver that final death blow, the fact that you were an associate of the person who did, you're a member of a gang with him, you were present at the time, under certain conditions, that means that you can be done not just for conspiracy to commit murder, for being an accomplice, you can be done for murder as well. And this has come into the news quite recently, but the history of it is actually quite fascinating. So the doctrine initially emerged as a way to stop aristocrats from dueling by incentivizing it to be such that if you were merely in the proximity of aristocrats undertaking a duel, it would be in your legal interest to try to discourage them from engaging in it.
So this is we have a sense of this being a law that was brought in to deal with kind of gangland violence, but it's been on the statute books for many, many years.
It's been on the statute books for many, many years, or more specifically in the common law for many, many years. Probably the most famous case was in 1952. You had a couple of kids who were knocking off a candy store. One of them shoots and kills one of the police officers who catches them in the act, but the other kid is done for murder and hanged for it.
Mary, this misinterpretation of the law, what's felt to have gone wrong here then?
Well, I think that when the Supreme Court really gave the lower judges pretty large ticking off and said that they'd said in no uncertain terms that they'd been getting it all wrong, because they had been interpreting, as I understand it, they'd given too much weight to simply being along with what was going on. And they had assumed that people who were there when murder, especially a murder, when a killing was committed, that they should, even if they couldn't necessarily envisage that such a crime would take place, it would be assumed that they were, as it were, along for the ride. And the law was, it became more and more used to deal with gang killings, especially killings by young gangs, so where there were sort of three or four people together. And sometimes it was a solution if it wasn't clear, or the person who'd actually inflicted the fatal blow either wasn't identified or refused to testify, and everybody clammed up because that was the way gangs work. So the Supreme Court obviously felt that joint enterprise was being used too often, and too many people were being convicted for very, very serious crimes on that basis, and there was a backlash. One of the reasons why the Supreme Court looked at it was because there was a backlash on the part of relatives of people who'd been, especially young people, who'd been convicted and sentenced to very, very long sentences. And they came back and said, look, this is absolutely inimical to common justice. That, okay, so they may have been there, but they hadn't a clue that anybody was going to get stabbed, let alone killed, and they don't deserve this sentence. And that was the, as I understand it, that was the genesis of the Supreme Court looking at those judgments.
Yeah, Jeffrey, was, you know, when you don't know the law and you see it being used in this way, it reminds you of, you know, despotic nations where, you know, like for political crimes, all sorts of people are rounded up because they know somebody who did something. And this law, as Mary said, was particularly used in recent times against lots of young people who, you know, would in, by necessity be going out with large groups of people. They're young, they're hanging around with crowds, and sometimes terrible things happen. But what will happen now? What's the process? So there's a series of appeals that are being brought, but I understand that up to 700 people could try and have their convictions overturned.
And you have to imagine that that large number is part of what's motivating the Court of Appeals' reasoning here. So in this opinion, in the previous opinion from February, the Supreme Court insists on a more stricter standard about what it means to be subject to the doctrine of joint enterprise. And as Murray rightly says, before it was mere foresight. If it was foreseeable that this murder, for example, was likely to occur, that was enough to establish your guilt as a co-perpetrator of the crime of murder, even if you didn't intend to be part of it at all. And now the Supreme Court says, no, we have to establish on the basis of evidence, we have to prove that these associates of the main perpetrator actually intended to support this murder. For example, there needs to be a record of them encouraging the murder. Now, this is a much stricter standard, but if you insist on this standard, then a lot of the cases that have gone through fall away. I mean, in this case that the Court of Appeals ruled on today, it was the first of 10 test cases involving 13 different defendants.
And what was their ruling, by the way?
So the ruling today was to deviate from the Supreme Court, was basically to say that they would not overturn these cases. And there are two thoughts that come out in the opinion. One thought that comes out in the opinion is it's probably true that even if the Supreme Court's more stricter standard had been in place when these convictions transpired, these people probably still would have been convicted. That was one idea. But the other idea was a deeper one, and it was the idea that, look, we reinterpret our understanding of the law over the decades, over the centuries, and we can't constantly be going back and changing earlier rulings as our understanding of the law evolves. So there was an argument based on legal stability and predictability that was also in the opinion.
But there are a number of cases going through. So is there still a chance that these 700 people who are hoping to appeal will appeal, or do we feel that this is going to go against them now?
I think they'll still appeal, and even this case will be subject to appeal. The important point made by the Court of Appeal is that simply because they decided that these convictions wouldn't be overturned, that doesn't mean that all future convictions wouldn't be overturned. So there's still scope for overturning in future cases.
But I think you also have to take into account that presumably they started by appealing the cases that they thought were most likely to be overturned on appeal. And that the judges have simply upheld the verdicts. And I just wonder whether by upholding the verdict, first of all, the lower court judges are sending a message to the Supreme Court, but also whether, in fact, most of the judgments did observe the stricter criteria, even though maybe in the judge's summing up or in the actual verdict that wasn't completely clear. And it appears to be, at least in this first appeal, that they were within the provisions even of a stricter interpretation of joint enterprise.
Well, finally this evening, once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered, weak and weary. Well, it's the one night of the year where the sight of a witch or a zombie sitting next to you on the underground is entirely expected. But at least in the case of London, it hasn't always been the case. Halloween has long been celebrated across the US and a few other nations too. But in recent years, people in all pockets of the globe have been stirring their cauldrons and rising from their coffins to join in the fun. What's pushed the sudden popularity of Halloween? Jeffrey, your accent, you're from where? Where's your hometown?
I'm from just north of Boston, Massachusetts.
Okay, so you sound like somebody who, when they were like 5 years old, definitely had a bucket and was trick-and-treating.
We would have a map of the neighborhood and we would identify the most strategically efficacious route because we knew the direction most of the other kids were going. So we wanted to do the reverse so we could hit the houses. We'd also skip houses whom we knew from previous years, gave out particularly small quantities of candies, who were stingy with giving out candy, and we'd go to the houses that we knew would give out the biggest candy bars.
And what about trick? Is it only treats really when kids go around?
Kids are only interested in the treats, that's for sure.
Okay.
Kids are only interested in the treats.
And did anyone ever scare the death out of you?
No, I was too concerned to get my candy. I was too concerned to get my candy, right? Move on if anything frightens me. That was my philosophy.
Mary, you've got good stateside connections. I've worked in the US. What do you make of Halloween as a global export from the US?
Well, I think it's extraordinary how fast it's actually taken off. I mean, this has been going for decades and decades, if not centuries, in the United States. But it's only, I would say, in the last 10 years and possibly in the last 5 years that it's so prevalent across Britain. And I think one thing is that it's just hugely attractive, the whole visual thing, the pumpkins, and it's all the sort of craft.
Well, I don't think we used to have pumpkins even, did we? Well, that's an American import as well.
No, but mini local Sainsbury's has got gigantic pumpkins, £2 for a big one, £1 for a small one. I don't remember seeing that. But I also think that it may have been sort of encouraged or gained a hold also in schools, primary schools especially, because it's one of the few festivals in the UK which doesn't actually reflect some sort of religious confession. So everybody,
although there are quite a few church people who don't like it because they think it's kind of, you know,
not, you know, it's irreligious.
Oh, my late mother strongly disapproved of Halloween.
Well, I'm surprised this whole affair has taken off at all.
She thought of it as dabbling in the dark arts, and she was definitely against it. But I think those views are dying out, and instead are coming in fancy dress parties, trick-treating, pumpkins, and everybody having a great time that has nothing to do with religion.
You've only got 2 seconds to tell me, really, Geoffrey, but when you leave here tonight, is there a pointed hat and a cape waiting for you?
You better believe it.
Good. I genuinely believe him. That's the good thing. Well, that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. Thanks to my guest, the very scary Geoffrey Howard and the sometimes scary Mary Jajewski. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland, definitely scary. Researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, not really very scary. And also by Daphne Carnesis. And our studio manager was the frightening Toby Hammond. More music next, then at 1900 hours, we'll continue with the Halloween theme. But for me, Andrew Tuck, it's just time to say thank you very much and goodbye.